Hello, everybody. This lecture is on Kanchenjunga, which is a movie by Satyajit Ray. It will be short, but I want to draw attention to some things about the film. So the film was made in 1962, 15 years after India got independence from Britain. During those 15 years, for the first time in the history of cinema, non-Western cinema began to become prominent, not just in the production of popular films, which had been happening in India for quite a while, but also because of the production of films that garnered very good critical reaction, both within the context of the countries where they were being produced, as well as in the West, which back in those days is what mattered to most of these artists coming in general from post-colonial societies. The most important films of that era were produced in Japan. Tokyo Story being perhaps the most, the one that has survived best in the minds of critics as far as reputation goes. But in India, where Bollywood was in the process of becoming a major force, the films produced by one director turned out to be the most important films of the period. And that director was a Bengali working in Calcutta by the name of Satyajit Ray. He is supposed to have been very strongly influenced by Italian neorealism, and it's quite possible that he was. In fact, that used to be taken as a truism at one time, though it is increasingly challenged by commenting on his work. The most important film that he made in that period, which in Bengali is called Pathir Panchali, but in English it's translated into Song of the Road. This film from the mid-1950s was the first Indian film that generated a lot of very good critical reaction, including winning prizes in several festivals in Europe, though it was slightly less well known in the United States. It's a story of a boy growing up in a village, generally without the presence of his father, who's away trying to earn her money. It's a film about poverty. And the film is based on a very famous novel by a Bengali author by the name of Bibhuti Bhushan Bandyopadhyay. And it is beautifully shot in black and white and established Ray, if nothing else, as a very, very competent cinematographer. Earlier than that, Ray had also had a lot of contact with Jean Renoir, who was in India in the late 1940s and then in the early 1950s to film one of his great films, The River, which had the same theme as Rules of the Game, in the sense that it displayed a bourgeoisie that was completely unaware of the social context in which it worked. And Ray would have worked on the film, except he had to earn his own living, and he was working for an ad agency at the time. But a lot of the people around him, his associates, worked with Renoir in that movie. And those associates are the ones who went on to become part of Ray's crew. Now, Song of the Road was based on a novel that had a sequel, and Ray used the sequel to generate two sequels also to the film. And all of these are called the Oppu trilogy, where Oppu is the name of the little boy that grows up and eventually has a son of his own who returns to that village and repeats that life. And so by about 1960, the Oppu trilogy had fully established Ray as a major figure in world cinema. And then suddenly in 1962, he produces this film called Kanchenjunga. Today, almost 60 years after that film was produced, we can go back to it. And it is absolutely fascinating because of the ways in which, and that's what I'm primarily going to talk about now, in which the film was way ahead of its time. But at the time when it was made, it was almost impossible for its audiences to make sense of it. And I will say quite a lot about this as to why audiences could not make sense of it, and why right now we realize it was something that was rather unique and culturally extremely important. Now, look at the two audiences. So first, let's start out with what the film is. it's a remarkable film in the sense that it is absolutely rooted in classical ideas of the unity of space and time. All the characters carry out a series of conversations. That's all that is there in the movie, somewhat like My Dinner with Andre that we've looked at, which comes from a much later period. And these conversations are all carried out in one road that encircles the peak of Observatory Hill, a small mountain that dominates the Indian hill station of Darjeeling. And it's one afternoon, they just circle it, they talk to each other, and the film has nature reflecting the state of the mind of the characters. Whenever the characters have a lot of doubts and are worried about what they're doing, the entire set is shrouded in mist, which Darjeeling is famous from. And at the end of the film, when the characters have achieved some clarity in terms of what they set out to do and what was important for them, suddenly the mist disappears, and dominating the entire scenery is the range of the mountain Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest peak in the world, one of the major sites of the Himalayas, and generally regarded to be the most beautiful mountain range of the Himalayas. And it dominates the town, and that's what makes the town a major tourist center, and gives mystique to what the town was supposed to be. Now, nothing happens in the film. There is one plot where it's basically an encounter between a very rich Anglophile family run by a patriarch, Indranil, who is not exactly a character that we're supposed to respect. And then there is a very poor family of teachers, Ashok and his uncle, and they are the ones who, if the film has a hero at all, Ashok is the hero in a way. There are subsidiary themes that also run through the movie, including the failing marriage of Indranil's oldest daughter, where her having an affair almost leads to an end of the marriage. But the love that both she and her husband has for their little daughter somehow saves the marriage at the end, as she decides to end the affair and focus entirely on making sure that the daughter has a proper home. So that's all that there is to the story. Nothing much to it at all. And of course, then there's a third theme where Indranil is encouraging very strongly that his younger daughter happens to marry a very rich engineer. And this daughter has a mind of her own. And at the end of the film, she decides to reject this engineer in spite of being encouraged by her father and in spite of the fact that the engineer is socially high up in the ladder and also very wealthy for that period. So that's all that there is in the scene. Now, how would audiences react to it? Now, Western audiences expected something more exotic in the sense they wanted this to be like Ray's earlier films, which do not deal with modern India at all. It's village life in rural Bengal, and all the characters are presented as essentially being rural people untouched by modern civilization and life in the urban centers that British India constituted, and therefore generated a vivid image of what rural life in India was like. In particular, if you look at audiences in the United States, this is the India that was invoked by Gandhi when most of India did live in villages, and there was Gandhi wandering around in half naked, as Churchill called it, and emphasizing village life and the role of the villages in Indian culture and so on. That's the India that the Americans had come to love and worship, and they were the major backers of Gandhi and his crusade to get India independence from the British. From their perspective, what you suddenly saw appeared to be these Indians who half the time spoke in English, wore Western clothes, and in the case of Indranil, pretended that they were, to some extent, British themselves, and who were far, far more comfortable with British rule than what modern independent India threw at them. And so from their perspective, it was a picture of India that was not the idealistic picture that had come to love and in some sense really appreciate. I mean, Gandhi had a tremendous influence on U.S. culture, ultimately influencing Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. Gandhi was somebody that every American child heard about in schools and elsewhere. And that was what the India that Gandhi celebrated was the one that Ray had depicted with such skill in his earlier films. And this film was nothing like that. The exotic was not available to them. Weirdly enough, though, the film, when you consider the Bengali audience of the film, it is exotic. It was right at the beginning when you have the credits, which are written in Bengali. The Bengali is made to look like Tibetan, and that's not entirely surprising or difficult, given that the Tibetan script is derived from the Bengali script, or whatever it is. And then you have images of Tibetan dress with the aprons and for front of the skirts and all of that. And so for Bengalis, at least Darjeeling represented the entry, and not unfairly, the entry into the exotic land of Tibet, about which people heard more than ever knew. It was always a land that was difficult to visit. And even though Bengali preachers, Buddhist preachers and others, had penetrated Tibet for almost 1,000 years, Tibet remained something exotic. But that was not something that Western audiences would know. In the meantime, Bengali audiences, of course, were horrified at how Bengali culture was portrayed. In particular, Bengalis regarded themselves as being the intellectuals of India, perhaps with some justice, but also with a fair amount of arrogance. Way back in 1913, the greatest author that Bengal produced, Tagore, got the first Nobel Prize ever awarded to an Asian, and in fact remained in the 1960s the only Asian writer to have gotten the Nobel Prize for literature. And Tagore wrote a very, very beautiful and pure Bengali in which no English words were mixed up or any of that. And here we have a film in which virtually every character spoke in English at some point and sort of seamlessly went from using English to using Bengali and back again to using English, sometimes for emphasis and all of that. The extent to which a character used English varied. In general, it varied with social class. The more upper class you were, the more wedded you were to Anglophilia, the more English you used, even in conversations with each other. And the more lower class you were, English was used less and less, but nevertheless, it was used all the time. In fact, as I have argued many times, that there is a different way of speaking, that this way of speaking where you seamlessly go from one language to another, which is called Benglish. And Benglish is a rather strange thing. It's not really a Creole. You're not mixing up the two languages. You're just switching between the two languages while fully being aware of the rules of each. And it is a way of speaking that is hard to make sense of from any of these perspectives. Now, as a consequence, Bengalis were reminded by this film that this is what they actually speak, the Bengali bourgeoisie, the ones who were rich enough, upper class enough to go watch a movie of this kind. And they hated what it reflected of their culture. And so this film was basically ignored. It was considered to be the odd film out of Ray's corpus. He went on to make many, many great films afterwards. And even though he emphasized to anybody who talked to him that this film was important to him, it was extremely personal to him. It was a film that back in that period did not receive any critical attention at all. And that's the strangeness of this film. Now, the other standard way to look at Indian culture and art, and to some extent culture elsewhere, is through what are called subaltern eyes. This was a perspective that was developed by Indian historians and sociologists, and I should say Bengali historians and sociologists, back in the 1960s and 1970s, where they brought a new kind of approach to looking at and telling Indian history, where they neither relied on the great men, generally men, sometimes women, the great men who created this history, all the kings and princes and generals and freedom fighters and all of that, and instead turned to people that were called the subalterns. These were the lowest rung of the British Indian Army, the people at the bottom at the bottom of the hierarchy of power, and what did the world look like from their perspective? It is sort of similar to people writing about the people's history of the United States and things of that kind. So a perspective that came from those at the bottom, and the whole issue was whether or not certain episodes in this history could then be seen as subverting the social order, and in people, the subalterns got empowered by it. Well, that does not happen in the... What we see is the patriarch gets his will thwarted and he's very unhappy about it. But the victory is a personal victory of the people surrounding him, but not really something that changes the social order in any radical way. That is not something that this film does noticeably at all. So what is it about this film that would make it important, given that you do not have any of these standard hermeneutic ways of looking at it? Well, the best way, I think, as scholars have begun to realize now, is that it is a film about what postcolonial studies call hybridity, where you embrace Benglish and you recognize that that is the culture that is authentic, the culture of the pure Bengali of Tagore, or the culture of these unsullied villages of Gandhi. That is not a culture that dominates India anymore. Ray has recognized that the colonial impact on India is permanent, and the impact of the English language on the Bengalis is indelible. It cannot be wiped out. And a consequence of that, that you have this complete mixture of cultures where it's very difficult to make a distinction between the self and the other if the self happens to be either pure English or pure Bengali, and the other happens to be, in the case of the English, the Bengali, in the case of the Bengali, the English. That is not what is at stake. A new form of living, a new culture has emerged, and that is why you see Himalayan, ethnically presumably English, Sikkimese, Lepcha, that those kind of musicians playing Scottish bagpipes. You see haunting music that is hard to place in any single culture. You see this mixed up language, and then you see dress of those at the upper limits, Indraneel, is indelibly British, and you should not despise it as just sort of being the people who are copying their masters. No, this is what he's really comfortable in. This is what, given his economic status and this minor title that is given to him, he feels is entitled to and enjoys. He smokes his pipe, he carries a cane, and he is dressed in formal clothes. And then, even at the bottom of the rung, when you consider the family of teachers, the uncle is dressed in Indian clothes suited for the much hotter plains and modified with scarves and other things just enough to make sure that he does not find the cold of Darjeeling, which is some 7,000 feet above sea level. He does not find that comfortable. And this hybridity, which has been emphasized by Homi Bhabha, who's a professor of Chicago, is absolutely crucial to understanding what is happening in this film. And it just permeates the film entirely. And whether you like it or not, and audiences in the 1960s did not like it, that is what this film is about. It is about the fact that a new hybrid culture has emerged in India. But that is not enough. What I also like to emphasize is that for this particular film to be able to depict hybridity, you also needed the place. The film is also very much about what as a place is in the Bengali psyche. Ray visited Darjeeling as a child. He tried to recall that, and one of his great memories of that childhood, his father was dead, his mother was working to support him. He was dependent very much on the charity of other members of the family. But one of his great memories is being woken by his mother at dawn one day and looking out of the window and seeing the mountain Kanchenjunga dominate the scenery of Darjeeling. And the city and the mountain went together. The city has a long history as one of the most exotic hill stations founded by the British in India, the gateway to Tibet and the Himalaya and the whole bit. all of that plays a tremendous role in what Darjeeling is in the psyche of this people. And as a consequence, transgressions are allowed. Ashok says that there's absolutely only in Darjeeling would be walking around talking to the daughter of a very rich family and on easy terms with each other. The daughter makes him his friend. There's hints of romance in that. And the daughter says even when they go back to Calcutta, where this special place is no longer available to them, he would be welcome in her home. Something that is almost unimaginable from the point of view of Indranil. Ashok feels he's empowered to refuse the job that Indranil offers him, even though this means persisting in poverty, struggling to have ends meet by being a private tutor to a variety of students. All these transgressions of the social order are made possible because of the sense of place. And the extent to which hybridity and place interact with each other is what is intriguing about this film. The last point I want to make about it, and we'll have plenty to talk about in class, is that we do not notice how technically well-constructed this film is. And particularly, we do not notice the extent to which sound is successfully integrated with everything else in the film, including the Scottish bagpipes, the sounds of the Himalayas, the music of the Himalayas, the Bengali singing of Indranil's wife. All of these come together to, in a rather perfect, I wouldn't say perfect, in a rather impressive way. And that is the hallmark of an auteur. Ray was a great filmmaker, and here co-expressivity is quite supreme. And all of it, this is his first film in color. He makes the color subtle, and when you're a mountain where there's a lot of mist, the subtle changes of color, which almost merge into black and white, is what your visual experience is. And all of this is put together technically in a rather superb way. And that is something we have to keep in mind. But at the end of the day, whether we like this film or think that the early critics were completely justified in panning it, is going to depend on what we think about both the existence and the depiction of hybridity in this film, and then also the way in which a sense of place can pervade a film. I think I will stop here. This has been a short lecture, but there'll be more to talk about when we get to it.